Hey, this is Drew Tarvin from Humor That Works, and if you want to learn to go all in every aspect of life, you should be listening to Screw the Side Hustle with my fellow nerd, Kevin Mills.
If you are looking for just another ordinary business podcast, then stop listening right now.
You are about to be bombarded with actionable content from thought leaders and successful entrepreneurs from all over the world. If you are looking for inspiration and motivation to change your life, then don't go anywhere. You are listening to Screw the Side Hustle with your host, Kevin Mills.
Hey guys, what's going on? And thanks for tuning in to another episode of Screw the Side Hustle. And today we have an absolutely awesome guest. I was watching this guy's TED Talk and knew I had to have him on the show. Andrew Tarvin is actually the world's first humor engineer. He teaches people how to get better while having more fun, and combining his background as a project manager at Procter & Gamble with his experience as a stand-up comedian, he reverse engineers the skill of humor in a way that is practical, actionable, and gets results in the marketplace. Through his company, Humor That Works, Andrew has worked with more than 35,000 people at over 250 organizations, including Microsoft, the FBI, and the International Association of Canine Professionals. He's a best-selling author, has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Fast Company, and his TEDx talk has been viewed more than 3 million times. Andrew Tarvin is an absolute legend, and if you guys haven't already, please head over to iTunes, leave us a rating and review. That would be fantastic. It would mean the world to me. But without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Andrew on the show.
Drew, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. So, you know, right here at the beginning, I don't want to go all the way back into your backstory. We may touch on that just a little bit as we get going. But when I first found out about you, Drew, it was actually on a TED Talk. Absolutely loved it. It was awesome. But I started looking into your backstory, following some of the things that you had put out there. And what really, really struck me as super interesting, borderline crazy, is how you go from an engineer, right? That is one of, I mean, pardon how I explain this, but it's one of the most bland jobs out there, right? An engineer, you typically see them behind a desk, pretty boring, to a stand-up comic, right? Which is night and day. So take a few minutes and tell me about that transition and kind of where you got the inspiration to make that transition originally. You know, were you into engineering as a youngin, or was it a comic, right? And why you made that transition there?
Sure. Well, first I'll say to my fellow engineers kind of listening that at least from an engineering perspective, I don't think engineering itself is boring. We do often sit behind a desk, but hopefully we're working on cool problems. But I'm a little bit biased in because I think that I was born an engineer. Certainly was not born a comic, was born an engineer to the point that even in the womb, I was obsessed with efficiency because I was born 3 weeks early. So like, I don't need a full 9 months. I'm ready to go right now. And that was always my mindset. Like, I remember when our family got our first computer, I was like smitten. I was like, you know, I was the person that was taking the computer apart and seeing how it worked, putting it back together. I joined the internet club in high school and we built our high school's first website, got a degree in computer science and engineering from Ohio State. Like, always academic, always loved math, always into technology. That was kind of my foray into things. And it wasn't, the comedy was later. And certainly like on paper, the jump seems massive, right? Going from engineering and working at Procter & Gamble to then doing stand-up comedy and later speaking on humor. But it's interesting because I think there's a lot of logic in humor. There's a lot of kind of exploration. And I think of comedy almost as math with words. And so I think the engineer in me was drawn to comedy because there are similarities that I saw in the work. And the other thing that I noticed was that humor was a really effective tool for the hardest thing that I ever had to work with, which was other humans. And so that dual thing of like logic plus it being effective with people, helping me solve problems with humans, was what I think led to such a passion for it.
So would you say that, because you know, most people that are comedians, it's kind of an inherent thing that they're born with almost, you know, they're the class clown, things like that. I mean, I understand that you were really into technology and engineering from an early age, but was that a similar case with comedy to you? You know, were you always cracking jokes at school, or was this something that you learned to use as a tool?
Something that I learned to use. And I think that, I don't know, I think it's interesting to think about, because people are like, yeah, you're naturally funny, or you're like a natural born leader. And I don't know that those things are necessarily like, natural is an interesting word, because I think people think that it means like encoded in our DNA, like that it's a genetic thing. And maybe that's part of it. But I think a lot of it is they're simply behaviors. And if you can learn those behaviors, or if you can do the actions of what a comedian does, then you become a comedian, right? If you get on stage constantly, and that's why I say humor is a skill, right? It's something that can be learned. And, you know, in our programs, we say we can teach anyone to be funnier. Not necessarily like across the board funny. It's not like, oh, you do one workshop and suddenly you're going to have a Netflix comedy special. But it's like cooking. Right? It's like anyone can get a little bit better at cooking. There's some people that naturally know, like I'm a terrible cook. Because if you're like, oh, just add a pinch of salt. I'm like, how much is a pinch? Like add a little bit of sugar. Like that's, no, I need the quantified amount.
Right, put it on paper.
But by following, yeah, exactly. Put it on paper. But following a recipe guide, I can get a little bit better. And if I were to do it more, I would be a better cook. I'm not going to become Gordon Ramsay, but I'm going to be better than where I was. And I think humor is the exact same way. So for me, you know, I always appreciated humor. For me, I wasn't what the person, like a lot of times comedians are like, I was watching The Tonight Show and I saw, you know, Rodney Dangerfield on there, or I saw Richard Pryor and I was like, that's what I wanted to be. That was never me. Growing up, it was more like I loved comic strips. Like I love The Far Side. I love Calvin and Hobbes. That's what I would read every Sunday, is like I'd get the newspaper and then go straight to the comic strip section and read that. But that was like the extent of what I would do. I would every now and then share jokes. I found an old video of me where I would share a joke. And the joke was, the Ohio River is flooding. Damn it, damn it, damn it. And I love that joke because it was wordplay and it allowed me to cuss, you know, as a kid. But that was kind of the extent of it. I wasn't the one cracking jokes in school. I was the one doing my math problems and trying to get ahead and like, you know, very, very academic. So for me, it wasn't that natural thing.
Gotcha. So was there ever like a light bulb moment for you when you realized that, you know, this is something that you could use to better yourself in your career? Or was it more of a gradual thing that you worked into?
Yeah, it was a gradual thing. I mean, I wish I had that sexy story of it was, you know, it was a Tuesday and it was raining out and this thing happened and suddenly it all clicked. And I feel like for a lot of people, or at least for me, that's not how the change happened. It was a gradual thing. Because, you know, starting comedy, I wasn't even the type of person that was like, oh, I saw a comedian do that. I want to get on stage. No, my introduction into improv was my best friend in college wanted to start an improv comedy group, needed people, and forced me to join. And so it was like us, basically a bunch of friends kind of hanging out. We had no idea what we're doing. We watched Whose Line Is It Anyway and tried to repeat what we saw. And for me, it was just an excuse to hang out with some friends. In fact, I was, so that group at Ohio State is still going on and celebrating its 15th year. We were just recently back and was talking with one of the people who have gone through the program or gone through the group since I left. And it came out that a big part of, I think, the success of that group, or at least my interest in it, was I had just gone through a bad breakup. So in college, like I broke up with my high school sweetheart. She broke up with me. It was tough for me. So I poured everything into this brand new thing that we're doing, which was improv. And it became this outlet. It became this thing that I could like focus on and was something that I was surprisingly better at than I thought. Like I didn't think of myself as a performer, but in this improv thing, I could kind of make people laugh. And then some of us in the improv group were like, okay, this is going well. There's a stand-up competition at Ohio State. So we're like, all right, if we're funny when we make it up, maybe we'll be funny when we write it down. So we all tried stand-up, and turns out that stand-up, at least for me, is way harder than improv. But then I fell in love with that because stand-up was the first time that I knew for sure that I by myself was funny. Because like in an improv group, you have other people, and I was like, maybe I'm just surrounded by funny. Maybe just the people around me are funny and they're making, you know, they're the reason I'm getting a laugh. But then when I got that first laugh, and I didn't have a great set, but I had enough of a set that was like, okay, the ideas that I thought of and the way that I structured them, people laughed at. There was still that logic to it of like, okay, how do I solve this word problem so that people do laugh at these ideas? And I poured myself into both of those things. And that was the gradual process of me falling in love with comedy. And then it was a gradual process for me realizing that what I was learning in improv and stand-up was actually helping me in the workplace and could be something that I could train.
Gotcha. So let's spend a minute or two here and talk about what came next. So in college, that's where you first really discovered improv and stand-up and things like that. And you're going to college for engineering, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. right? So you graduate college. Did you go straight to Procter & Gamble then?
Yep. Yeah. So I did a short kind of intern program with them after my sophomore year of college, then uh-huh. a full, you know, summer long internship with them after my junior year of college. And then I had a job offer from them by the time I was going into my senior year. And for a little bit of context, because this will set up the story, you know, when I leave a little bit later, I grew right. up in Cincinnati. Okay. Which is P&G's global headquarters. And so like the job to want to get is P&G. Because like with the cost of living in Cincinnati, the fact that I grew up lower middle class, like that was the creme de la creme type job to get, because it meant that you were going to be comfortable. It meant that you weren't going to live paycheck to paycheck. It meant that you're going to have an interesting job and have some job security. You'd retire a millionaire in stock options by the time you were done, and you'd be comfortable. You would have that like kind of American dream of, you know, buy a three bedroom house, have, you know, a significant other, 2.5 kids, a cat and a dog, a SUV and a motorcycle, you know, by the time you hit your midlife crisis or whatever. Like that was kind of the career path. So yeah, going into my senior year of college, all of that was kind of set up for me. In my last year, I was really exploring this idea of improv, but I was like, there's no way I turn that down. A bunch of my friends were going to Chicago to take classes at Second City. And I considered it for a brief moment of like, do I want to pursue this a little bit more? But I'm like, no, I've been working since the seventh grade. That's when I knew I wanted to work in IT. I've been working since the seventh grade for this opportunity at P&G. There's no way I just like throw that away for improv. And so worked for a year and a half in Cincinnati and then moved with P&G to New York because they had a small office in New York. And that was intentional on my part. I told my management that I was like, I want to move to a bigger city because I want to experience life outside the headquarters. I've never lived outside of the state of Ohio. And secretly for myself, I was like, okay, if I go to a big city, I wanted to go to Chicago, but if I go to a big city, I can take an improv class. I can take some stand-up class or do a little bit more stand-up and explore that as a potential option. And so I wanted to go to Chicago. They're like, hey, we have this opening in New York. I was like, I guess that's okay. Nice. And moved there. And that was 2008. So I've been there for 11 years. You know, I've been in New York for 11 years since then.
Gotcha. So at the point of when you moved to New York and you kind of had the improv thing in the back of your head, at that point, it was still kind of like a hobby phase to you, right? Mm-hmm. You weren't really seeing it as a long-term career. Am I correct?
No, I hadn't. Yeah, I hadn't started Humor That Works, which is a company that I ultimately run full time now. I had by that point, so 2006, I start working at Procter & Gamble. 2007, I had learned about this benefit of humor in the workplace, so I proclaimed myself the corporate humorist of P&G. And so I'm still doing my project management work, but I got, you know, business cards made. I started an internal blog about humor in the workplace at P&G. I kind of assumed that someone would stop me, right? That someone within a conservative organization like P&G would be like, hey, you just can't create your own job title, let alone one on humor. But instead, no one did. People started referring to me as a corporate humor. So I started blogging more and more about that and exploring that as an idea. I moved to New York in 2008. 2000, 9, I explore a bunch of different things. So I'm like, okay, I don't think maybe I'll stay at P&G forever. So do I want to become a comedian? Do I want to become a writer? Do I want to do editing for film? Do I want to maybe try to be an actor? Like all of these different, a lot of like what I was seeing other people in the improv and stand-up community do. And then by 2010, I kind of settled on this idea of humor in the workplace, that I like stand-up, but I didn't want to be traveling to all of the different places, you know, every single week in another small town.
Right.
And I'm not a good actor. If I'm not playing me in a part that I've written for myself, I'm terrible. I'm not good at making it look like I'm listening to something for the first time. Like if I'm in a scene, I'm just like clearly staring at you waiting for your cue so that then I can say my line. But the speaking in this idea, speaking was basically stand up with a message. And for me, the engineer to be able to make people laugh and then also tell them how to get better results, how to communicate more effectively, how to be a stronger leader, I really love. So then 2010 was kind of that evolution to then saying, okay, I think this is what I want to do.
Gotcha. So I want to take a step back just a little bit, back mm-hmm. to when you moved to New York and you're still working at P&G at that point. Let's fast forward to about your 3-4 years into P&G, mm-hmm. which is what, you know, as you grow up, you know, really heavily into technology and a desire for engineering and everything, you're literally in the dream job, so to speak, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Did you ever feel that way, or was there always something else out there kind of pulling you in a different direction?
I mean, I felt fortunate for the job that I was doing, and it's not like I hated it, right? I'm not that case of like, oh, I wanted this to be the dream job and I got into it and I hated it. Again, I don't have the sexy story. I don't have right. the like, you know, I flipped over the table when I left, stormed out in a huff, and I did the whole like, F you, F you, F you, you're cool, F you, like storm out. Like I didn't do any of that. But what happened was, you know, P&G was fine. It was mm-hmm. maybe like a 6 or a 7 on a scale of 10 to passion of the work that I was doing. Cause I was also intentionally making the work more fun for me, right? I think right. I'm a big believer in when you're in an organization, you have the ability, if you have a good organization, you have the ability to shape what you want to do. So I was shaping my role continually to do the things that I wanted to do to make it more interesting. So it was probably 6 or 7 out of passion. It was just the speaking and the stand-up and the humor piece started out as like a, you know, 6, because it was kind of interesting, but I'm uncertain about it. Then it became a 7, then an 8, then a 9. And then it was like, oh no, this is a 10 out of 10 on Pat. This is what I want to do. And so it wasn't that the other thing was so terrible that I needed something else. It was more that this new thing is more interesting and more compelling. So I want to give it a go.
Gotcha. So let's take a second and talk about that transition, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think that a lot of the listeners, when they hear these different stories about people that say, screw it, you know, I'm going straight after what I want, my dreams and desires and everything. A lot of times we get so bogged down in that transition period, you know, mm-hmm. someone that's working in a 9-to-5 job and they want to be a professional Hulu twirler or whatever, right? Their number one question is, how do I make that work, right? Mm-hmm. How do I get out of this and get into something else? So take a second and tell me about that transition for you. Was it I was an engineer one day and a comic the next day? Did you kind of ease into it? What did that look like?
Yeah, I eased into it. And the sexy answer this time is a spreadsheet, because I love spreadsheets. So 2010, right, I've gone mm-hmm. through, I've experimented with a bunch of stuff. I think, okay, P&G, there's enough at P&G to say, okay, this isn't what I want to do full time, right? So there was at least enough. So maybe it dropped from a 6 or a 7 to like now a 4 or 3. So there's enough to say that I didn't want to do this. I didn't know 100% what I wanted to do. So I experimented. I just tried a bunch of different stuff. And it was like, okay, what one am I good at? What am I passionate about? What do I want to spend, you know, the 10,000 hours to achieve mastery at? And what can I make some money from? And the speaking was the thing that kind of stood out. And so I created a spreadsheet called Operation Leave Corporate America. And the spreadsheet was basically, this is the project manager in me. I was like, all right, if I can manage projects for a $350 million business at P&G, I should be able to manage a project from me, you know, leaving and doing the thing that I want to do. And so the spreadsheet included things like basically the list of things that I needed to accomplish so that I could feel comfortable leaving and that I'd be leaving on a good foot. Because if you leave and can only, you know, feed yourself for a week before you have to like get another job, maybe doesn't quite help. But if I could create, you know, one, if I had a website that actually had a client list up, if I had my actual product offerings done, if I've delivered X number of events outside of PNG so that I have an actual body of work that I can draw from, if I have pictures of me at events to show that I actually do this thing, if I have a little bit of video, maybe some testimonials, so I have like the marketing stuff to support it, if I have a little bit of money saved up so that if I don't make money right away, that I don't have to, you know, go back and get a job immediately. So these were all the things in the spreadsheet. And I'll be honest, it wasn't immediate. It took me 2.5 years to check off every single thing from that spreadsheet. But as soon as I did, basically the day after I checked it all off, I went into a meeting with my manager and was like, all right, I'm going to leave. And then I didn't leave that day because I didn't have an immediate starting point. And I wanted to leave on good terms because like, okay, maybe if this doesn't work out, I'd be able to come back to PNG. Doesn't happen a lot, but it could happen. So I was like, I want to leave on really good terms. And so I talked with my manager and we realized that the end of the fiscal year would be the most convenient time for me to leave and for him to bring someone else in. So that was 4 months away or so. And so I worked those 4 months in transition while also prepping a little bit more work. And then started Humor That Works full time. And that was July 1st, 2012. Was my first day full-time, and I've been doing it ever since.
So as you know, the name of this show is Screw the Side Hustle, right? Mm-hmm. And with that being said, I just want to get your perspective because you seem like the kind of guy that really maps everything out, right? Mm-hmm. And does it the smart and right way. I want to ask you, how important do you think it is to be all in and not have one foot in and one foot out? Did you see a very big drastic difference in the success of your businesses when you went from hobbyist to full-time?
For sure. Well, and I think also, because I agree with this mentality of all in, but I think you can be all in while still doing something else as long as that thing is in service to the main thing. To the main hustle, right? And so even though I was at PNG for another 2.5 years, and you can see it in my ratings, like when I was, before I decided that this was a thing that I wanted to do, I was top rated. That's why I was able to go to New York. That's why I was given some of the opportunities that I was given. Once I decided this other thing, you start to see my rating slip a little bit because I wasn't all in the PNG job. I did enough to kind of like make sure that I kind of delivered on everything that I said that I would deliver on. Everything else was focused on the other thing. So I was spending 8 or 9 hours a week at work, but sometimes focused on a few other things. And then I would go to an improv class or an improv show, or I would go and do stand-up, or I'd be researching this thing, or I would take a vacation day and go and speak on this subject matter, or I would take an entire week off to make sure that I could convince myself that I could still be disciplined and get work done even when there wasn't a manager looking over my shoulder. I was working on the weekend. So I was all into the business. Right. And so what that did is keeping the job helped me. One, it kept me kind of like sane on certain hours. It allowed me to build up a little bit more of a runway. But the reason why I could do that was because I knew it was in service to something else. If I hadn't committed to myself that this was a thing that I was going to do, I would have, like you said, just kind of like, oh, every now and then I'll work on it. And maybe I should do that this weekend, but I'm tired, so I'm not going to. It's like, no, I was all in to say, the only reason why I'm at PNG is because it's now filling this need to complete this spreadsheet. And I know that, okay, once the spreadsheet is done, then I'm going to jump into it. And that's why, one, I had the passion to do it. And two, I didn't feel like it was a big risk to leave. Like a lot of times, and a lot of people have asked me like, was it scary to like leave? And the answer was no, because I had this spreadsheet, because I had done the work beforehand, and because I had like reconciled with myself. And I didn't know it kind of at the time, but I've realized that whenever I make a big decision, so whether that was leaving Cincinnati to move to New York, or leaving PNG to start this own thing, or I was a nomad for 18 months. And that's where that the other book comes from, the United States. So that comes from was I went to all 50 states in a year. And so people are like, oh, was it scary, like giving up all of your stuff and living out of two carry-on bags for 18 months? And whenever I made a big decision like that, I asked myself three questions. And the three questions are, one, what's the worst that could happen? And the answer is death. Always death is the worst could happen. But aside from that, what's the worst that could happen? So in the PNG case, the leaving my job case, it'd be like, okay, the worst that happens is I am either a, it doesn't work at all. Like no one gives me money. I don't make any money, or I hate it. In which case, then I get another job in IT with PNG on the resume and a degree in computer science and engineering and some social skills. It's like, okay, I think I'm going to be able to find another job. So that's not the worst case scenario. So that's question number one is what's the worst that could happen? Question number two is what will I regret more not doing? And so this comes from, they did a study with people who were in later stages of life and essentially kind of in hospice or on their deathbed. And the biggest thing that people regretted wasn't things that they did, it was the things that they didn't do. And so I create this question of, okay, what would I regret more not doing? And so I realized that, yeah, in the future, I would have regretted not trying to see if Humor That Works could work. If it could be a business, I would have always thought, oh, what if I had stayed at PNG? And then the third question that I ask is what makes for the cooler story? Because I do like, I don't know if you've ever heard that kind of cliche saying that's kind of like, if anyone wrote a book about your life, would anyone care to read it?
Mm-hmm.
I heard that years ago and for some reason it stuck with me and it's like, oh, I want to be writing a story that people would want to read. Not necessarily because I'm going to write a book, you know, a memoir, although the United States of Laughter is a travel memoir, but not because it's like, oh, hopefully, you know, this later becomes a movie or a documentary or whatever, but more that it means that I'm doing interesting things. Is it a story that I want to tell, right? Because we are the authors of our own story. And so I realized, oh, leaving PNG to start this thing in this kind of weird niche of humor in the workplace and humor in engineering, I think that's a cooler story. Same thing with becoming a nomad. I had lived in New York at that point for, you know, 8 or 9 years. And so I knew that story, but I didn't know what the story was going to be of me striking out and living out of two carry-on bags. And so like, all right, let's explore that story.
I love that. One of my favorite things that I got from what you just said there and those three questions that you asked yourself is what's the worst that could happen? I absolutely love that because, you know, so many of us are so scared about failure, right? We're so scared about embarrassing ourselves. But really, when you sit down and think about what's the worst that could happen, it's not going to be the end of the world. So if you would take a second and share with us, you know, one of those major failures that you've had, because I know you've had it. Everyone has, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and two things that I'd say as I set that up. One is there's a fantastic quote from Bill Burr. The content of it is he's talking about people who like try to be stand-up comedians and things. And he's like, failure is not being in your 30s and like sleeping on a futon because you're pursuing a dream. Failure is waking up at like 35 next to a significant other that you don't actually care that much about with kids who you like don't actually enjoy raising in a job that you actually hate. Like, he's like, that's what I'm scared of. I'm not scared of eating ramen noodles and sleeping on a couch, like something to that extent.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, that's not the mindset for everyone. Cause part of it, you know, part of success is defining what success looks like for yourself. Right? If success is, and I met this guy at PNG. I remember meeting a guy at PNG that did not want to get promoted. And I didn't understand that. Like as a type A ambitious person, I was like, no, I'm going to try to rise as far as in this company as I can. Even if I am going to leave, I still want to leave at the highest level that I can be at. And he had defined his success as I want a job that pays a comfortable salary. I want projects that I'm interested in. And I want enough time that I can leave whenever, kind of whenever, quote unquote, whenever I want to, so that I can get home for my kid's soccer game or to take my boys to Boy Scouts or to have date night every single Wednesday with my wife, you know, whatever it is. And he's like, with the promotion comes an increased expectation of responsibility and number of hours worked. And he's like, so I don't want those things. He's like, I don't want to be an entrepreneur because I want this time with my family. So that was his definition of success, which is fantastic. Mine changed to be like, oh, I want to create something that doesn't exist in this world otherwise, right? My books would not exist if it weren't for me. And I think there's something kind of cool about that. The other thing that I'll say to kind of set up this question around failure is, and this came from improv, which was a huge help, is that failure is just data.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just data to say that the things that you tried didn't work.
100%.
So for example, like I think about the worst stand-up show that I ever did was number four, my fourth stand-up show that I ever did. I was still in college. It was in a stand-up comedy competition. It was a semifinal round. And for that round, they had brought in guest judges. And the guest judges were Mark Curry, I think, the guy from Hanging with Mr. Cooper, the TV show from like when I was growing up, Hanging with Mr. Cooper, Joe Coy, who's a pretty funny comedian, and Daniel Tosh.
He's one of my favorites.
Joe Coy?
Yeah.
He's fantastic. He's so good. And he has a recent special that came out. And then Daniel Tosh. And this was before Tosh.0, but still he was a pretty big comedian. Mm-hmm. And so I'm doing stand-up. I have a 6-minute set in front of 200 people. It's the first time my mom is seeing me, first time my brother is seeing me. The comedians are literally on stage with you, sitting behind a table kind of judging, and they're going to determine who goes into the next round. And I'm doing pretty well. I get 3.5 minutes into the set, and I completely blank on what I was going to say next. And I had memorized everything word for word. And so I couldn't remember the next couple of words, so I completely blanked. And I stood on stage for 30 seconds. And I know it's 30 seconds because I recorded it and I can go back and watch the pain if I need to. And for 30 seconds, I look down and say, wow. Sorry. Wow. 30 seconds of that. And then eventually I skip whatever joke I was working on, remembering the tail end of it and go through it. And it was, you know, the most awkward period of my performance career up to that point. It was so awkward for my family. Like my brother wouldn't watch me do stand up for 4 or 5 years after that because he had felt so awkward for me. Even when I was like, no, I'm good now. I can actually do this. It's going to be a good show. He wouldn't watch because he remembered the pain of that awkwardness so much. And I realized afterwards, there's two learnings kind of from that. One, not to memorize my set word for word, right? Like it works better if I'm a little bit more extemporaneous where I know kind of what my punchlines are, but the segues and everything to those punchlines are going to change each set. And that's a good tool for speakers in general, is be more extemporaneous as opposed to being quote unquote right, correct according to a script. And the other thing, and this I heard Chappelle articulate pretty well a little bit later, was he's like, when you bomb in stand-up, no one dies. No one is injured. It feels awkward and it's not great, but his thought got back to the idea that if this is the worst that can happen in this career is where you feel terrible, you know what? I can do this. If this is the lowest, I've already hit the lowest. So that means if I'm okay with this and can survive this, then it's only kind of up from here. And so that, it took me a couple of weeks to kind of get around to that, but it got around to that, like, oh, okay, yeah, failure in this case is just data, means that it didn't work. What can I learn from it? And boom, how do I move on?
Yeah. Yeah, when you first started answering that question and you were talking about the definition of success and how you define it, and that really impacts, you know, what you consider a failure, right? That got me thinking about something that I'd really like your input on. One of my favorite, and this is kind of related, but not kind of related. but one of my favorite quotes is that you don't have to love what you do in order to love your life, right? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the most common thing out there right now is pursue your passion, do what you love, and you'll never work a day in your life. But my perspective is that if what you do allows you to do what you love, then you'll love your life, right? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. And I think the other thing is, and there's an important distinction, right? Because a lot of people say, yeah, if you do what you love, yeah, you'll never work a day in your life. And I think it's less about doing what you love and more about finding ways to love what you do.
Absolutely.
Because the idea of doing what you love, people then think, oh yeah, like, you know, if you're like, I love watching Netflix, right? Well, technically, there is a job as movie critic, right? So you could get that, but you might end up hating that because now the thing that you were passionate about became this thing that you now have to do for money and you have to churn things out. Or let's say you even love that, you may not love that you have to send admin. Or like the fact, I love what I do. I love the job that I have. And I feel like in some ways I'm doing what I love, but I don't love sending invoices. Right. I still have to send them. I don't love some of the work that I have to do. It doesn't mean like, I think the misconception is people here doing what you love. And that means that they have to love 100% of everything that they do. And instead, I think a stronger strategy and one that you can implement, if you're listening right now, you can implement today, is to start finding ways to love what you do. And that difference is, one, it's about a choice about where you are right now. It's about finding ways to make things more enjoyable. It doesn't mean that everything is going to be perfect. It doesn't mean that you're going to love every aspect of it, but you start to change your framework and how you think about things. And that ultimately leads to greater success. In fact, they've done studies that happiness precedes success, right? If you can find ways to be a little bit happier in your work, you see an increase in productivity by 37%, I think, in one sales team. And you see an increase in engagement and other things. And that's where humor comes from. For me, humor is a strategy. One, for you to enjoy your work more, and two, to get better results, because it's an effective strategy with humans. And it's a choice that you make every day. It doesn't matter what your work is. You can decide how you do that work, right? Because no one, even if you have a manager that no one, like, that says no fun whatsoever, one, that's kind of a dying breed. They're not going to last too long, especially with the you know, millennial generation and Gen Z coming up, where they seek value as fun is one of the values that they're seeking in the workplace. Two, they can't control how you think. They can't prevent you from listening to a comedy podcast on your way home from work so that you laugh and show up a little bit more present for your family. They can't prevent you from, one of the things that I like to do is I like to read emails in a different accent in my head. If I'm getting bored while emailing, I just start to read them in a different accent in my head just to make it a little bit more playful for myself. Mm-hmm. No one can stop me from doing that. So I think it first starts with, you know, making this choice around loving what you do, finding ways to love it. And then to your point, when you connect it to that greater purpose, right? When you've defined that success, the work is no longer just like, oh, why am I doing this? And this, you know, my manager is terrible and I hate when they have to do this and I have this job task that I have to do, or even this role that I'm trying to do now. Like, it becomes like, oh no, all of these things are in service to a greater goal. They're in service to me loving my life. It's in service to me being able to watch as much Netflix as I want, or traveling to all these places that I want to go to. And I think those two things kind of combined together help to make love what you do a stronger kind of sentiment than doing what you love.
Well, Drew, we have covered some absolutely phenomenal content, especially what keeps resonating with me. And to the listeners, you'll be able to find this in the show notes, is those three questions that you said you need to ask yourself. But before we wrap up here, I want to roll through what we call the lightning segment. Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's just a few quick questions that we're going to want a few quick answers from. Mm-hmm. So first, if you could tell your 18-year-old self one thing, what would it be?
I mean, the cliche answer is like, invest in Google when it comes out. But the other thing, more realistic, I would say is do stand-up comedy earlier.
Awesome. How important is a morning routine to you?
I think habits are important because they turn productivity into autopilot.
How do you consume content most often?
Mostly online on a computer, more so than on my phone, and mostly through Reddit. That's my primary, like, if I'm going to go and disengage, Reddit's the place I go.
Gotcha. So what's one subreddit that you would suggest to someone?
Let's see. In general, data is beautiful is a great subreddit, just a fascinating way of looking at data. And then the MBA subreddit community is, it's the reason why I love the MBA as much as I do now, is because of the subreddit.
Gotcha. What's one thing that you believe that most would disagree with?
That actually most people agree, but I don't think that they live their life with this kind of principle, but that you are responsible for your own happiness.
Who is or was your biggest mentor?
Biggest supporter is and has always been my mom. Mentor, I would say currently there's a fellow speaker named Phil M. Jones, who is so phenomenal at what he does and also has been a great supporter and mentor of the work that I do.
Gotcha. What's the biggest misconception about working for yourself?
One, that you will love every moment of it. There's going to be a lot of stuff that you do just because it has to get done. Things like accounting and all of that, I think is probably the biggest misconception. The other, at least maybe it's not misconception, but watch out, is that the thing that you miss from working in an organization is there's no one looking over your shoulder. So you've got to be even more disciplined. Like no one's going to make sure that you actually wake up and are productive in the morning. So you have to force yourself to actually do it.
Absolutely. And then lastly, where's one place online that we'll be able to see and interact with you the most?
Across all social media at Drew Tarvin. I'm putting more and more effort into LinkedIn. It's one of the areas that I actually really like. So I would, if you want a specific one, is LinkedIn.
Perfect. And then I know you've got 3 best-selling books out there, a lot of different content on places like YouTube, things like that. If someone wants to learn more about you, what it is that you do, where would you send them?
Sure. If people want to learn more about the idea of humor in the workplace and how they can use humor to get better results and have more fun at work, they can go to humorthatworks.com. And we've got plenty of blog posts, a free newsletter, link to the most recent book called Humor That Works, an online course, our workshops, all that kind of stuff is at humorthatworks.com. If they want more kind of interaction with me, as I mentioned, social media is Drew Tarvin, D-R-E-W-T-A-R, V as in Victor, I-N, across all social media, including YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and recently discovered still have a MySpace page. So if MySpace is your jam, myspace.com/Drew Tarvin.
I didn't even know that website was still kicking.
It's around. I added a couple of more recent pictures, but it's mostly old stuff from 2008.
Yeah. All right. So humorthatworks.com. Thanks, Drew, for coming on the show today. It was an absolute blast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, guys, again for listening. Don't forget, guys, I want to hear your feedback on the show. Head over to Instagram. That's kind of where I'm most active right now at Official Kevin Mills. Shoot me a DM. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show.